So was Henry David Thoreau, the author of Waldron, really a Unitarian Universalist? Or was he the first American Buddhist? And if he was, why should we care? That is the basic question that prompted me to write this sermon today. And I'm squeezing it in under an anniversary deadline because this rapidly disappearing year of 2017 marks 200 years since Thoreau's birth. His actual birthday was this past summer on the 12th of July, and I was a long way from anybody's pulpit on the 12th of July. So here we are, just in time and under the wire with my Thoreau sermon. Thoreau's bicentennial year has been more widely recognized, actually, in the literary community than the religious community. He is a cultural icon because, and many of us know this, remember this, for many years he was a staple of high school literature courses all over the country. And of course, his quotes have been featured on inspirational posters suitable for all kinds of people. Quotes like, "If you have built castles in the air, now put the foundations under them." Or, "To affect the quality of the day, that is the highest of arts." Or, "If a man does not keep pace with his companions, perhaps it is because he hears a different drummer." And that Republican favorite, "That government is best which governs least." I have no doubt that there have been sermons by many other UU ministers this year, despite no major celebration being encouraged by our denominational leadership, given the ambivalent relationship that Thoreau had with institutional Unitarianism. Despite that ambivalence, we love to claim him as one of us. And there's plenty of good reasons why we would want to be associated with Henry David Thoreau. He is a major figure in American literature. He is the patron saint of the modern environmental movement. His attraction to the woods and the ponds of his neighborhood over against the town, his meditative reveries within the natural world, his keen eye of observation, and his eloquent reflections on the mystery and the majesty of nature is what most people think of when Thoreau's name is mentioned. But UUs love him for much more than that. He is associated with the leaders of the 19th century Transcendentalist School of Philosophy and Literature, which so influenced the development of the Unitarian Universalism that we have today. He is routinely cited as a prophet of nonviolent civil disobedience due to the influence of his writings on Gandhi and on Martin Luther King Jr. And his opposition to paying taxes for war and to the institution of slavery and his willingness to harbor a fugitive slave have endeared him to those who seek role models for peaceful resistance to tyranny and oppression. It's quite a resume for a man who only once ventured more than 20 miles from the house he was born in Concord, Massachusetts, and who liked that just fine. Just in case Henry David Thoreau is no longer fashionable in high school literature or environmental science courses that you may have taken, let me just take a minute to remind you a little bit about the basics of his life. He was born into a Unitarian, and at that time, Christian family, a shopkeeper's family. David was actually his surname that his family gave him, and David was the one chosen among his three siblings to be the most suitable for the family to invest in an education at Harvard College, which was sort of at that time like a graduate school from middle school. You went there when you were 16. His career at Harvard was undistinguished. He was seen as standoffish. He graduated and got a teaching job for a short while, but quit when he was told that he would have to inflict corporal punishment on the students. So he and his brother took over a school in Concord that they managed and ran it for 3 years until his older brother died tragically of an illness. And without him, the school closed. Thoreau's relationship with the town church in Concord, the Unitarian Church, was distant and he asked that his name be removed from the membership rolls, although his family and especially his mom remained very involved. There was another church member and Concord resident in town, the Reverend Ralph Waldo Emerson, who took an interest in young Henry. Emerson had only recently abandoned himself a career as a Unitarian minister because he did not want to serve communion and decided he would set out and make his living as a lecturer and writer. And Emerson invited young Thoreau into his family's home as a handyman and gardener in 1841 and became his mentor in writing and in philosophy. He arranged later on for his work to be published, for Thoreau's work to be published. He helped him find another teaching job. And then in 1845, he offered Thoreau the use of a piece of property that he owned on a little pond called Walden, about a mile from town. Thoreau had long wanted to experience a more solitary life and to devote more time to what he called his saunterings, long walks in the woods, and to be able to further his interest in writing. So that spring, that's 1845, Thoreau built a small cabin on Emerson's property, and he lived in it for 26 months. The book that he finished years later, describing his life and experiences at Walden, finally, after his death, became a best-selling classic, as did his essay on civil disobedience, which was a reflection on his brief imprisonment in the town jail for refusing to pay taxes because of his opposition to the Mexican-American War. After Walden, Thoreau got involved with his family's business, which was pencil making, and beyond that, he gardened, he walked, and he wrote about his experience. A long-running struggle with tuberculosis, not an uncommon disease in that time, took his life at the age of 45. I've actually always been much more personally interested in the details of Thoreau's spiritual life. And clues to that are found in his Walden journals, some published in the book and others not. As a Unitarian Universalist Buddhist myself, my curiosity about Thoreau too is especially piqued by his association during that time in his life with the first ever publication of a Buddhist text in America, which was a translation by Elizabeth Peabody from the French of the Lotus Sutra scripture. I found out, checking out Thoreau's spiritual practices, he was also an early American investigator and sympathizer with Hindu spirituality, and he tried yoga. So I wondered to what degree Thoreau's interest was encouraged by his intellectual curiosity, or whether it was a steady and consistent personal spiritual practice that made that was more influential. And this brings me to the second occasion that made this sermon something I wanted to do this week, because this week is actually another anniversary that isn't celebrated very much around here. No one is actually sure of the actual date that Buddha got enlightened, but there is a holiday in Buddhist tradition called Bodhi Day, Enlightenment Day, and it's traditionally celebrated around the 8th of December. I was actually in Hawaii last week, and I was quite aware of it, signs on various Buddhist temples. So it's a part of American culture in places where there are more Buddhists. So at this time of year, Buddhists remember the story of Buddha's decision to leave his privileged family when confronted with the disturbing realities of illness and aging and death. And we remember his conviction that he must renounce the world and undertake ascetic practices, almost to the point of his own death, before he gave up on that and realized that was not going to help him achieve the wisdom he was seeking. And he decided instead to simply sit in meditative contemplation, hoping, waiting, just being present, until he had an experience that changed his life and changed our world. Many millions of spiritual seekers have wondered about and sought after that experience through following the teachings that Buddha offered for the next 35 years after he had that enlightenment experience. So there is no evidence that Thoreau was in any way a formal Buddhist practitioner. And yet, the way that he writes about his personal routines and his experiences at Walden very much evoke the practices and the insights and the wisdom of those who follow the Dharma way. Thoreau isn't the only American literary hero to be mistakenly identified as an American Buddhist. The Beat Generation novelist Jack Kerouac, author of On the Road and The Dharma Bumps, actually read much more Buddhism than Thoreau ever did, and identified with the Buddhist tradition at some key times in his life when he was writing, before returning later in life and for most of his life to the conservative version of Roman Catholicism that he had grown up with. What Kerouac and Thoreau have most in common is not their interest in Buddhism, but their appeal to younger adults who are at a stage in life developmentally where it is totally appropriate to be challenging authorities that are part of their lives as a way to find your own identity. Both Thoreau and Kerouac did what a lot of young adults do after a period of self-discernment. They travel away from home, they discover more about themselves, and then in some fashion or another they return to hometown or family home and rediscover, whether they ever live there again or not, the lives that their parents have led, but now on their own terms and through their own understanding. It might be more accurate to describe Thoreau not as an early American Buddhist or Unitarian, but as the first American SBNR. You know what that means? That's the shorthand term that today's sociologists of religion are using to describe the millions of people in this country who say they are spiritual but not religious. And there is no doubt that Thoreau could be very disciplined in his spiritual practices and his religious studies, and that his contemplative practice especially was very deep and routine in his life, whether he was doing it walking in the woods or sitting at home in his workshop or in his cabin. But all of this was done outside of the guidance of any teacher or religious community. Plenty of people who will write about Thoreau note that his supposedly isolated life in the woods at Walden Pond was within walking distance of town, where he could actually go home and get his laundry done at his parents' house, where he could have dinner with friends or with family. He could even invite friends to come out to visit him, and he did, and they did. And they even had meetings there. So it isn't completely what the romantic affection for Thoreau has embedded in our minds. As this anniversary year has approached, there have been some pretty severe critics of Thoreau that have published and challenged this image of him as a saintly guy. And one particular essayist is just fun to read in how devastating she is, Catherine Schultz. She wrote a 2015 essay in the New Yorker that she called Pond Scum and described Thoreau as self-absorbed, cold, and contemptuous of other people and the lives that they shared in common with his. She wrote, "Although Thoreau is often regarded as a kind of a cross between Emerson, John Muir, and William Lloyd Garrison, the man who emerges in Walden is far closer in spirit to the philosopher Ayn Rand, that is, suspicious of government, fanatical about individualism, egotistical, elitist, convinced that other people lead pathetic lives, yet categorically opposed to helping them. It is not despite, but because of these qualities that Thoreau makes a convenient national hero." Pretty severe. So Thoreau's defenders have rushed forward to protect his image and legacy. But they do it in kind of the same way that Catherine Schultz did. They quote selectively a variety of different passages from his work and different episodes in his life. It's almost like using photos and posts from a Facebook page to sum up somebody's whole life. I wouldn't want that to happen to me. I don't know about you. Both critics and fans are guilty of trying to make Thoreau be just one thing to them, either a scoundrel or a saint or a hero. So which is it? I think it's safe to say it's none of the above. And I say further, he was neither a good Unitarian or a good Buddhist. As Thoreau's contemporary and his fellow transcendentalist poet and writer Walt Whitman said, "Do I contradict myself? Very well then, I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes." And so did Henry. So this is where I start to answer the question that I posed at the beginning of the sermon, the question about why we should care about the spiritual insights of this guy whose life, after all, began 200 years earlier than our own. Is there anything that Thoreau has to say to contemporary Unitarian Universalists about how to live a wise and good life? Well, I would say that there is much we can learn from studying him, but the insights we can draw are not all the wise epithets that are on the posters. We should follow Thoreau's own advice to study his life. If it proves to be mean, then we should get the whole and genuine meanness of it and publish its meanness to the world. And where it is sublime, we should know it ourselves by experience, not just because he did it or he said it or he experienced it. We should be able to give our own true account of it. Excuse me. So there's absolutely no question in my mind that Thoreau's monastic retreat in the woods at Walden changed him in a deep way. The legendary story of Buddha's enlightenment and his elevation to a godlike status within many devotional Buddhist traditions has given us an inflated picture of what this glorious state of enlightenment must be like it's some blissful consciousness that is forever beyond all suffering. Yet the mainstream of 2,500 years of Buddhist teachings is more, I would say, better summarized in the old Zen proverb, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. There is a moment. There are quite often several moments, many moments of deep insight in contemplative practice when body and mind fall away and the differences between self and other, between you and the world, are gone or at least are no longer important, no longer in the foreground. And Henry David Thoreau had many of those experiences, not only during his time at Walden Pond, but for years after, as he trusted the natural world to reveal both itself and himself in everyday ways. And he documented these moments with astounding clarity in his journals. Born in the 20th century, he very likely would have found his way into a Buddhist practice in America, and he might very well have become a great teacher. And if that was all that he contributed, these descriptions of these insights and contemplative experiences, if that's all he contributed to the literature of religion, just for that he would be worth our reading. But he was also a man of his own time, and it was in fact his experience of seeing time and himself in time that he often wrote about as a way to convey his mystical insights and vision. "Time is but a stream I go a-fishing in," Thoreau wrote. "I drink at it, but while I drink, I see the sandy bottom, and I detect how shallow it is. Its thin current slides away, but eternity remains. I would drink deeper, fish in the sky, whose bottom is pebbly with stars." To fish in the sky suggests that there is a way to live in the world where you see things differently, where things that are supposed to be one way can actually be another, where the categories that we use to compartmentalize our experience can be broken open. Categories like slave and master, prisoner and free man, work and play, human and animal, natural and created. They no longer need apply. They no longer suffice to capture our experience. So Thoreau's great fault and failure both as a proto-Buddhist and as an example of a person seeking to lead a life of spiritual insight and integrity, is that he actually really did not like people very much. He preferred his own company, and it was a shame for him and a loss for all of us. In Buddhism, spiritual practice and a spiritual life is pictured as a stool that has three legs. The first is a teacher or exemplar, the Buddha. The second is a body of teachings and insights, the Dharma. And the third is the Sangha, the community of people that is involved with sharing your practice. Now, in this tradition, in Unitarian Universalism, we put Sangha first, because like Whitman, we believe that we contain multitudes. We don't want to limit ourselves to one exemplar who showed us all truth, or one body of teaching that is supposedly reveals all insights. And we're willing to live with the contradictions that this creates, willing to live with being dismissed by the more rigid and traditional in their view of religion as people who just don't believe much at all. So was Thoreau. But his rich and full life, lived in one place, was missing a community of spiritual companions that could share his insights. And these insights were documented more than any of us ever will succeed in doing, and yet they represent only the scum on the surface of the pond that was his life experience. The daily depth of experience that led him to be completely himself and none other is something none of us can ever fully understand. Donovan Hahn, who's one of Thoreau's defenders, says if we are willing to take on Thoreau as one of our literary and spiritual mentors, we have to accept him on his own terms. He was flawed, he was full of contradictions, and in Walden endeavored to document the changing seasons of his thoughts and moods as painstakingly as he did the temperature of the pond. He was of his time and of his place. He worked hard to attain a vantage point from which he could perceive both. Who are we and where are we? Are questions he asked, because for him those questions were both excellent ones and inseparable. Sometimes he will sound like a libertarian, sometimes like a progressive, sometimes like a conservative, conflicted as he was about tradition and change. He wrote a lot, and he wrote in contradictions. A lot of essayists do. So you could probably cherry pick a quote to recommend him for membership in the John Birch Society, the Communist Party, the Chamber of Commerce, or the Weather Underground if you wanted to. He had old-fashioned stoical ideas about manliness, and he prized it a bit over much. But he also considered Margaret Fuller a soulmate. He was a moral philosopher, a patriot, and a dissident, a prose stylist so exquisite that Dickinson and Frost and Tolstoy and Dillard all admire his sentences. He was someone who tried to write and live deliberately, and he succeeded better than most. An epic perambulist and a committed abolitionist, a sufferer from tuberculosis from his youth to his death, who nevertheless climbed Mount Katahdin, the tallest peak in New England, a naturalist who studied a pond, scum and all, so curiously and attentively he glimpsed an ecosystem and perhaps even an entire cosmos through the distorted mirror of his own reflection. I am not worth seeing personally, stuttering, blundering clodhopper that I am, Thoreau once wrote. Why can't we just take him at his word?